Chapter 4, South Fork, 1892. The narrator here is Angus McCaskill. He is 22 years old, in his third year in Montana after having come with a chum from Scotland to homestead on the North Fork of English Creek. And he's the narrator of the book. He begins this chapter this way. Ordain me here and now as the Lord High Kafuzalum, and I would be no more surprised than I was to be made the South Fork schoolteacher. Not that there was ever any supposition I was the pedagogical genius the world had been seeking since Jesus went upstairs. Rather, what designated me was that it was too near to school start that year to find a teacher elsewhere after Mavis Milgram married, and the only other person in the vicinity who had stood at the front of a classroom was Mary Finletter, currently a prominent 6 months into the family way. That's hardly my fault, I protested. Archie Finletter would be glad to hear that, observed Ninian Duff. Ninian and the other school board member, Willie Hahn, proceeded to argue qualm after qualm out of me. Yes, this was temporary for the year. They would find someone more suitable for next year. Yes, yes, they would see to it that I had help with my homestead's chronic chores of hauling firewood and fixing fence. Yes, yes, yes. They were certain as anything that a change from living with myself all day long would do me a world of good. But I know as well as you that the prospect of the teaching job pleased me. I have never pretended I am my own best paymaster. So the wage was welcome to help me climb out of Lucas Barclay's wallet. By Jesus, Angus, you're the first swamper the Medicine Lodge Saloon ever had that's turned out to be a schoolmarm, was Lucas Barclay's reaction to my new career. Two, there was that matter of the sheep partnership with Lucas's nephew Rob, and Rob's own set of ideas about how our woolies ought to be conducted, which I was amply ready to let Rob have some leeway about. Besides, I had come across the bend of the world from Scotland looking for new, had I? Schoolchildren are newness with the shine still on it. That first South Fork morning, the Hahn brothers were the earliest to trudge down the road toward the Waitful school and Waitful me, dragging with them that invisible Gibraltar of burden of having a father on the school board. The children from the other families of that branch of the creek as well, the Petersons and Rogers and Van Bevers, all lived near enough to walk to school, and soon they were ricocheting around outside in those double-quick games that erupt before the class day takes everyone captive. I turned from the window for one last inventory of my schoolroom. Desk rows across the room, blackboard, and a roll-down map of the world fastened above. Framed portraits of Washington and Lincoln, staring stoically at each other on the far wall. I hammered days of nails when this school was built. I had come here with Ninian Duff and Willie Hahn many times to tend to our teacher when I was on the school board with them. I had danced on this schoolroom's floor, mended its roof. Yet I tell you, it was a place foreign to my eyes as I waited for the minute when it would fill with pupils, my pupils. For the dozenth time, I looked at the alarm clock ticking on my solitary desk at the front of the schoolroom. This time it told me I had to ring the bell to begin school, even though a significant half of my pupil population hadn't yet appeared. Ring I did. In trooped the South Fork, boys and girls. I hemmed and hawed and had them take temporary seats until the others arrived, but still no others. Accident? Boycott? Jest of God? Possibilities trotted around in me until I needed to do what I had been resisting, retreat out onto the porch and peer up the North Fork Road. Here they came, the child cavalry of Scotch Heaven. The three Finletters, on a fat white horse named Snowy. Ninian's daughter, Susan Duff, regal on one of Ninian's blood bay geldings. Jimmy Spetterson, on a beautiful blaze face black, worth more than the rest of the Spetterson's homestead combined. Davy Erskine, on his fast-stepping roan with small sister Rachel clinging behind him. I let out a breath of thanks. But to show them I did not intend for tardiness to become habit, I stood conspicuously waiting while they put their horses on picket ropes. Already there on a length of grazing tether was the mare Patch that I was still riding. And with all our horses picketed around the schoolhouse, the scene suddenly hit me as one of life's instants I had been through before. When Rob and I gawked at the cowboys and horses of a cow camp, the day we arrived green as peas into the town of Grovan 3 years before, I reminded myself how greatly more veteran in life I was by now, and tried to believe it in the face of what advanced on me here, Susan Duff. Susan Duff poised below me as if she was bearing a message from Caesar. "We cut through our lower field and couldn't get the gate open, and the top loop is too tight and barbed wire besides," she reported in funeral tones. "My father will need to fix that gate." Unaccountably, my spirits rose as I thought of Ninian Duff having to deal with his daughter. Susan went on. "Meg Findlater's nose is running, and she doesn't have a hanky, and Davy Erskine forgot to bring his and Rachel's lunch." This seemed to conclude Susan's docket, and on the porch steps and into the schoolhouse, she marched with the other Scotch Heaven children in a straggle behind her. I kick myself yet for not anticipating the next snag of that morning, although I am not sure what I would have done about it. My gender. In Scotland, schoolmasters were thick on the ground. But here, having a man teacher proved to be an unexpected thought to pupils accustomed to Miss Mavis Milgram. The larger boys were plainly restless about me, and I was afraid little Meg Findlater's eyes would pop from her head every time I leaned far down to bring my handkerchief to the rescue of her nose. My predecessor still governessed that schoolroom in another way, too. After I had everyone sorted and seated, and the littlest ones were more or less occupied with the new things called desks and books, I started on my upper grades in what I thought was peerless emulation of Socrates. "Tell me, anyone, please. The presidents, from Washington to Lincoln." I drew back stairs. There I stood wondering what had taken their tongues, until Susan Duff informed me that it was the practice of Miss Milgram to tell the pupils such matters as the presidents to Lincoln, while they listened. "That's as may be, Susan, but I look very little like Miss Milgram, don't I? And so I need to do things my own way. Now, who'll tell the presidents, Washington to Lincoln?" A silence deep as a corner of eternity. As the silence yawned on, my only immediate hope was Susan Duff again. But a look at her told me she had lent me all the instruction she currently intended to. I despaired and was starting to reach for the chalk and begin listing presidents, anything to stir this congealed schoolroom, when I heard, "Hickory Jackson!" I turned, blinking. Davy Erskine was regarding me with a helpfulness that managed to be vague and earnest at the same time. I'd made mental note to share my lunch with him and his little sister Rachel. This opening effort of Davy's resolved me to give them it all. Taking my surprise for encouragement, the boy visibly searched around in his head some more. After a while, "Quincy Adams!" Yet another Davy spell of thought. Shakespeare could have written a couple of acts during this one, and "Some other Adams!" I was desperately debating within myself whether to shut off this random trickle of presidents, try to suggest some order into it or what, when Davy's thought-seeking gaze lit on the wall portraits. "Abe Lincoln," he announced to us. "George..." It was too much for Susan Duff. Up shot her hand. "Washington, John Adams, Jefferson," she launched. "Madison, Monroe, John Quincy Adams." That tiny box of school on the universe's ocean. How could we in there hope to know enough to get by on, let alone improve the race at all? I doubt seriously that, when that year's fractions of knowledge gain are added up, any of my Southwark pupils learned nearly as much as I did. There I stood, newly minted teacher of such topics as the history of the United States of America. With my Scottish schooling, which had instructed me thoroughly in the principal events, from Robert the Bruce to the Union of the Crowns, my daily margin of American history over my various grades was the pages I'd scurried through the night before. Fortunately, not all the subjects were as lion-sized as history. Even in America, lessons in handwriting were lessons in handwriting, and reading was reading. and spelling was spelling except when Harbor, H-A-R-B-O-U-R, arrived to this side of the ocean as Harbor, H-A-R-B-O-R. Tire, T-Y-R-E, is T-I-R-E. Theater, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, is T-H-E-A-T-E-R. And sundry other joggled vowels. But geography, the grief of American geography. When it came to geography, my pupils and I had to be strange pickles together. In that schoolroom of mine were children born in Bavaria and Scotland and Norway and Alsace-Lorraine, and others who had never been farther in the world than 10 miles down the creek to Grove On. Our sole veteran traveler of the continent we were on was Jimmy Spetterson, 7 years of age, who had lived in Missouri, Kansas, North Dakota, Manitoba, and now Montana, a life like a skipping stone. Whatever the roll-down map of the whole world proclaimed, every one of us there came from a different earth and knew only the haziest about anyone else's. For me, Terra Incognita was the 99% of Montana where I had never been. I could instruct my pupils perfectly well that Thomas Carlyle, he of "I don't pretend to understand the universe, it's a great deal bigger than I am," Thomas Carlyle originated at Ecclefechan, county of Dumfries in southmost Scotland, near to Carlisle and the Solway Firth. But I had to learn along with my pupils the 16 counties of Montana and the mysterious town names of Ikalaka, Weibo, Saco, Missoula, Shawmut, Rimini, Ravalli, Ovando. One geographic inspiration I did have, the piece of the planet that stayed with me as no other, the Atlantic Ocean we had crossed. The Hahn boys and the three Finletters, and Daniel Rozier and Susan Duff, and Davy and Rachel Erskine, also all remembered crossing the ocean to America. I strive to have them make the other pupils understand that feat of crossing, and to hold it in their own minds ever and ever. I got more than I bargained for. When Jenny Finletter hesitantly raised her hand and asked if, when I was on the ocean, was I scared any? "Jenny, I was," I said to Daniel Rozier's smirk and the careful gazes of the other pupils. "An ocean is dangerous enough to be afraid of, as are the rear hooves of our horses out there, and blizzards, and just a number of things in life. But we try to use our judgment and be afraid only when it's worth it, don't we? And then only as much as we have to be. Is that how it was with you, Jenny, when you were on the ocean?" Jenny's vigorous nod carried me from that trouble. Arithmetic. Thank heaven arithmetic is a neutral country. At least I could put addition and subtraction and multiplication and division into my pupils like nails into a shingle roof. Pound, 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 pound. Here was once when old Scotland came back to help me out, for when I had been pupil teacher in Scotland under Adam Willicks in our school in Nethermuir, Adam had made arithmetic my particular topic. "They can become literate from me, Angus, and they can learn to be numerate from you." So maybe it was numbers alone that kept me, that school year, from ever riding into Ninian Duff's homestead and saying to him, "Ninian, start advertising for someone else. This is beyond me." Instead, day upon day, I ransacked my brain for how Adam Willicks had done things back in Scotland, and then amended nearly all of that, for Adam and Nethermuir never had the situation of the Hahn boys' dog Wagger following them to school and howling by the hour, of keeping track of whose turn it was among the big boys to go to the creek and fill the water bucket, of Einar Peterson's perpetual tendency toward nosebleed and Jenny Finlater's toward hiccups, of having to watch for ticks on everyone, including myself, of having to deal with Daniel Rozier about the issue of the girls' outhouse. A country school such as South Fork was not an individual receptacle of knowledge. It was an educational trinity. You saw all three as you came to where the stream bed of the North Fork met that of the South Fork and made the main creek, just upstream, within a willow-thick bend, the white schoolhouse, and behind it, the white twin toilets. Girls to the left, boys to the right. Each waiting to do its duty, They sat there like an attentive hen and two pullets. My problem, or more accurately, the girl's problem, was Daniel Rozier's fascination with the possibilities of that left-hand outhouse. It all began with garter snakes. Most of the girls were not normally afraid of them, but go seat yourself appropriately and glance down to find restless green reptiles beside you and see what you think. I heard out the girls' lamentations and made my threats about what would happen to whomever I caught at snake work. But the Rozier homestead was just down the creek from the school, near enough for Daniel to sneak back before or after the rest of us, and try as I did, I never could convict Daniel. Susan Duff, rather than I, ended the snake episode the recess time when she stormed out of the girls' toilet grasping a writhing foot-long serpent by the tail, carried it around to the side of the schoolhouse where Daniel Rozier was in a game of anti-eye over, and whapped him across the bridge of the nose with the thing. Even if she was the avenging figure of justice, Daniel was livid about being hit by a girl. "Susan Duff, you're worse than snot," he screeched. "The next snake I find in there I'll hit you with twice," she vowed in return. And so, only two of the educational trinity were standing when I rode into sight of the South Fork the morning after that. The casualty, naturally, was the girl's outhouse, flat on its back as a dead beetle. The bad fact now was that even Daniel Rozier, at his most indignant, wasn't strong enough to tip over a two-hole outhouse. He'd had help from the other boys. It took Daniel and Davy Erskine and the Hahn brothers, conscript labor all, and me to lift the structure upright. Two mornings later, the girl's outhouse was horizontal again. By then, I knew Daniel Rozier was the sort you could punish until he was jelly, and he'd still behave the same. Instead, I opened that school that day with the observation, "A freak of nature seems to have struck the girl's outhouse." Smirk from Daniel Rozier to Susan Duff, glower from her to him. "Until it comes along again," I went on, "and puts the toilet back up, chivalry will have to be in force. Who'll tell me the spelling of chivalry? Daniel, crack at it, please." Daniel Rozier's smirk went, and confusion came. Is it S-H-O-V-U-L-R-Y? "Closer than you might think," I granted. "Susan, enlighten Daniel as to chivalry, please." Which she did as fast as the letters could prance out of her mouth. "Thank you, Susan. And now the definition, at least in this case. The boys will yield their toilet to the girls." Little Freddy Finletter, a lad with a nervous kidney, had his hand up in an instant. "Where will the boys go, then?" I directed attention to the willow thicket along the creek. "Like Zeus on Mount Olympus, Freddy, all of outdoors is your throne." Looks were cast toward Daniel Rozier, but the boys sat firm, so to speak, on their outhouse position. Montana weather being Montana weather, I didn't have to wait long for the next day I needed. Squalls were getting up speed in the mountains as I reached into my cupboard that morning, and by noon, hard wind and blasts of sleet shot against the schoolhouse windows. "My eyes must have been big this morning. I brought more than I can eat," I confessed during lunchtime in the schoolhouse. "Daniel, pass these around, please," handing him the big bag of prunes. Ian groped Daniel's paw for the first haul, and then the fruit began making its fist-diving circle among the other boys. When the prunes had time for full diuretic effect, and boy after boy trooped back in from the bushes as if dragging icicles behind, I decided here was my moment. "I've been meaning to ask, how many of you can stay after and put the outhouse back up?" Where it then held. "A coyote can too run faster than a dog, Petey Hahn," Jimmy Spetterson's contention wafted in through an open window as I was at my desk cramming that afternoon's American history. "Can't either. Our dog Wagger runs after coyotes all the time, see? Your dog can't catch coyotes. That's a fat lie. Liar, liar, pants on fire." Didn't say he catches them. See then? He'd have to run faster to catch them. What he does is, see, he keeps up with them. So a dog and a coyote run the same, see? They don't either. After recess, we'll ask McCasker. All right, then. McCasker will know.
McCasker, was I. It could have been worse. My pupils, my Minnow School of New Montana. It was like having a taste, a sample, of all of the homesteads of Scotch Heaven, day long in the room with you. Susan Duff had bones longer than they knew what to do with themselves in the manner of Ninian, so that her elbows stuck out over the aisle, the way his poked wide when he cut his meat. The Finletters all were marvels at arithmetic. The Hahn boys had cherubic, lispy voices like Willie Hahn's. You would never suspect that one, or more likely both of them, had just been in a fistfight during recess. Yet, I always had to watch out not to peg a child according to his parents or older brothers and sisters. Along came small Karen, of the cog at a time Petersons, and she had a mind like a magic needle. It penetrated every book I managed to find for Karen, and of my bunch in that schoolroom, Karen Peterson was the one spellbound, as I had been at her age, by those word rainbows called poems. When all was said and done, and of course more of the former than the latter, the learning drew down to the pupil and me, and I see now more to the pupil than me. Did I install history in Susan Duff? No, just carpentered around its edges a bit. Was it my doing that Daniel Rozier could never learn to spell more than half of any word correctly? Dear St. Peter at the gate, I hope not. I could bring the lessons to the eyeballs and the ear holes. Where it went after that, I could never know. For all the daily tussle of schooling, there were distinct times when I wished the rest of the world was made of children as well. I had wondered what some of the community of the South Fork and the North Fork thought of having me as a teacher, and I found out when the first dance of the year was held in the schoolhouse. Just after I had done a shottish with Rob's wife Judith, Alan Frew called out to me in a high girly voice,
"Angus, aren't you afraid your petticoat will show when you kick up your heels like that?"
I stepped over within arm's reach of Alan, which made him blink and think. "Ask me that outside," I urged him, "and I'll answer you by hand, Alan." That ended that. Then there was the matter that fists have never been able to settle. It had to be Ninian Duff to bring me word of this, and I give Ninian full due. He looked nowhere near happy to be performing it. "Angus, this business about the universe being too big to understand and all. I'm hearing from a few folks that they would like a bit more orthodox view of things told to their children. Of anything to be scanned and poked and sniffed in the making of education, this." So far as I could see, I was doing the job of teaching as well as I knew how. Probably better. To have it all snag in a sentence from Thomas Carlyle, himself a god wrestler right in there with the most ardent, it put my blood up. "Ninian, I can't get into that. You can say all day long you just want a bit of orthodoxy. But there's my doxy, your doxy, this doxy, that doxy. They're all somebody's orthodoxy. I don't notice Willie Hahn being here with you. Has he been saying I don't trot Martin Luther into the classroom often enough? And then there are the Roziers. I can invite the Pope to visit from Rome to please them too, of course, Ninian. Angus, I am troubled myself with this. The matter was simpler when we were over across in Scotland." "Oh, was it? Then you don't hold with the fellow who said the history of Scotland is one long riot of righteous against righteous. Now, Angus, don't start. You can fill your children with funnels of it at home, Ninian, as far as I'm concerned, but I won't do it for you here at school. If you want a Kirk school, then you'd better sack me and find yourself a preacher." Ninian by now looked more bleak than I'd ever seen him, which is saying a lot. "Eh, well, that's your last word, then. It's even the one after that, Ninian. Angus, we will leave this where it was. I have to go and tell them I told you." The long beard moved on Ninian's chest as he shook his head at me. "They don't need to know how hard of hearing you can be."
And then there was Rob. Rob, whom I had come from Scotland with. Rob, my lifelong friend. Rob, my partner in the sheep business. "You know you're demented to be spending yourself there in the school," Rob informed me when I first went to Breed Butte to inform him. He said it smiling, but I could tell he more than half meant it. "Of course," he went on, "that almost goes without saying about anyone as red-headed as you are, Angus. But you'll be glad to say it for me, even so," I finished for him. "And here I thought you'd be relieved to know there'll be a solid mind at the school for all the Barclays that seem to be on the way from your house," his wife Judith being notably along in her second pregnancy. Solid is one word for it," Rob admitted. "Thick is another. Angus, man, you're missing a golden chance by not coming in with Lucas and me on more sheep. With prices down where they are, we can buy enough woolies to cover this country from here to there." Lucas and thee and his money make three, I thought to myself, but said, "If you and Lucas want to be up to your necks in sheep, that's your matter. I have all I can handle and still take the school. And there's where I have a proposition for you, if your ears are ready." My offer was to provide the hay, a next summer's task that I could manage to do after the end of school, for all of our shared sheep if Rob would lamb them this coming spring with his and Lucas's bands. Rob looked the proposal over from every angle. He was getting surprisingly like Ninny and Duff in that, and at last said he guessed he could go along with such an arrangement. "But you're missing opportunity," he reiterated, "passing up Lucas's pocket this way when he has it open. Don't say I never told you." "Rob, I never would." So, without meaning to, there was no Greenock dock at the mouth of the North Fork Valley, no green funneled emigrant ship to America, hawsered in the clear ripples of the South Fork. I had become a divided citizen again, as I was when I left Scotland, divided between the homesteader families and their children, between sheep enterprise with a pair of Barclays and my own homestead, and between my homestead and school. So a flounce of several more hours onto each day, and maybe then I'd have had almost enough time for all those. As it was, I knew I was skimping everything else for the sake of the school, for my effort to be all the teacher I could, but I saw no other way. Say it better, wanted no other way. "A year is not forever," I told my other consciences. "Zephyrs from the latitudes of learning begin but in aspiration," I quoted righteously back at old Carlyle's universe, and came down the wind each morning to the South Fork School. "Flow gently, sweet Afton, among thy green braes. Flow gently, I'll sing thee a song in thy praise. My Mary's asleep by thy murmuring stream. Flow gently, sweet Afton, disturb not her dream." Some zephyrs in the school took more of my coaxing breath than others. Song time each week. Song time hinged on whatever Robert Burns was in my mind just then, and wherever Susan Duff's fine clear lilt led us. Neither premise was much my choice, but 1,000 hymns in the household of Ninny and Duff had built Susan a voice, even I had to admit, and I'd found it was like pulling teeth to draw song suggestions from my other pupils, even though the schoolyard often rang with one chant or another. Children are their own nation, and they hold their anthems to themselves. Ritually, though, I tried to pry music out of them. "You're like a school for the mute today. Now who'll tell, please, what we can sing next?" "I know one, Mr. McCaskill," piped Davy Erskine, standing and swallowing a number of times. Here was surprise. "Do you, Davy? Can we hear it now?" Another salvo of swallows. Then out quavered. Davy's song and the rest of this is on the other side of the tape, folks. "Do you, Davy? Can we hear it now?" Another salvo of swallows. Then out quavered. "I came down from Cimarron, a-looking for a job, riding for the outfit, They call the jingle Bob. The boss told me, stranger, let's have ourselves some fun. Come and throw your saddle on our horse called Zebra Dun. Oh, that old Zebra Dun, that bucking son of a gun, a-pitching his wall I'd fit, while upon him I did sit. The punchers came and gathered, laughing up their sleeves, counting on their zebra bronc to do just what he pleased. And when I hit the saddle, old Dunny quit this earth, went right up to try the sky, for all that he was worth.
Susan Duff was wrinkling her nose at Davy's minstrelsy, but as soon as I gave her a severe look, she joined in the chorus with Davy and me, and the rest of the children followed her. Onward Davy warbled with his verses.
Old Dunny pawed the moon and passed right by the sun. He chased some clouds a while, then came down like a ton. You could see the tops of mountains under our every jump, but I stayed tight upon his back, just like the camel's hump. We bucked across the prairie, scattered gophers as we went, kicked the cook and stew pot right through the boss's tent. But when the fray was over, and Zebra done all he did, no doubt was left in this world that outlaw I had rid. The boss whooped hurrah and threw the hat high off his head. He shook my hand until it ached, and here is what he said. If you can toss the lasso like you rode old Zebra Dun, you're the man I have looked for since the year of one.
Davy Erskine, that was remarkable. It was more than that. There were days when Davy was so drifty he could scarcely remember how many fingers he had. And where did you learn that tune, Davy? From Mr. Fox and Mr. Mitchell. I had to expend a long moment to translate Mr. Fox and Mr. Mitchell. The writers, Perry Fox and Deef Smith Mitchell, they took supper with us when they were writing for Strays. They said it's a song from Texas, Davy reported, as if the place was blue heaven. Texas is where I'm going when I grow up. That may be, Davy, but for now, you're going to arithmetic. Davy and Susan and Daniel and Einar, your book is page 132. Karen, show the others where they're to read, please. At the close of school that day, I stepped out, as always, to watch the children start for home. The walkers up the South Fork, the riders up the North Fork. The white horse load of little Finletters. Susan Duff aboard her blood bay. Jimmy Spetterson on his black pony with a blaze face. Davy Erskine urging his roan with Rachel tight behind him. It was Davy I was seeing most of all. Seeing older Davies, although their names were Rob and Angus, hearing their own tunes of a far place. A late afternoon near the end of the school year, Ninian Duff appeared in the schoolroom as I was readying to go home. Angus, I've been by to see Archie and Willie, and we've made our decision on next year's schoolteacher. Have you now? I'd been more and more aware that my time at the South Fork was drawing to a close, but it made me swallow to hear the fact. I hope you found a right one this time, Ninian. Hey, we do too, he delivered right back. It's you again. Temporary, of course. Just for another year. I thought the beard was going to drop off Ninian when he heard my stipulation for staying on as teacher. Draw ahead on your wages! Angus, who in this world ever heard of a thing like that? You have Ninian, just now. I'm standing here wishing thoroughly I had not. Ninian, in fact, was striding back and forth in front of my desk like a scarecrow in a cyclone. I'd need to talk anything of the sort over with Willie and Archie, of course. How much is it that you want to draw ahead? I don't know yet. Ninian halted. Angus, what has got into... I don't know yet how much the horse is going to cost, Ninian. Horse! Where does a horse enter into any of this? The new horse I intend to buy, Ninian, so that I'll at least be riding something better than my pupils do. The rest of that I will let tell itself. A Saturday, as usual, the wind put its breath in my ear as soon as I rode up onto Breed Butte. But not as usual, instead of reining towards Rob's place or toward Grovan, I pointed my horse Patch across the divide of the butte and down, north, to Noon Creek. Patch's plodding pace reinforced my conviction that buying another horse from Dantley in town would be like throwing the money in the stove, so I was on my way to do something about that. Isaac Reese's horse ranch was as far up Noon Creek as mine was along the North Fork, comfortably near the mountains without having them squat on you. And Isaac Reese had been issued the right face for a horse trader, for he showed no twitch of expression when I stepped off the Dantley nag as if I was a plump hen seeking a chopping block. When I told Isaac my purpose, he only asked in some accent my ears were not prepared for, "How much horse?" I took that to mean how much was I willing to pay for a horse, and began the sad hymn of my finances. But Isaac Reese meant what he said. He studied me, eyeing my long legs, and judged, "You vaunt about him high," holding his hand at the height of my nose. Had you tried right then to tell me how Isaac Reese was going to figure in my life, I would have laughed you over the hill. Plainly, this was a man who knew horses. What else he knew, and I entirely admit it turned out to be a mighty total, was as unclear then as his version of English. Isaac was a Dane who had made his way across America with the railroad that was being built north of the Two Medicine River. My bet is that Isaac learned his English, to call it that, from someone else who didn't speak it as an original language. It was Isaac who would make famous a Noon Creek winter when the temperature rose from 20 below to zero by observing, "Der thermometer fall up this morning." What Isaac Reese led out for me was a high horse, no question about that. At his shoulder, the horse stood nose high to me, as prescribed by Isaac, a tall gelding of a striking strong brown color, odd in a horse, remindful of dark gingerbread. Maybe I was no great equinist, but at the wheel shop in Nethermuir in Scotland, I had seen enough horses pass through to fill a corner of Asia, and I thought here was something handsome. I stepped closer to admire the steed, and companionably rubbed his velvet neck while asking Isaac, "What's his name?" "Skorp, Jan," Isaac informed me. That had a pensive, homely Scandinavian ring to it, and I was on the verge of asking what it translated to, when it came clear to me. "His name is Scorpion?" I verified, stepping promptly back to where I had begun. There ensued from Isaac a scrambled egg explanation that the horse was titled not for his personality, but for the brand on his right hip, a script M with a long tail on it. Isaac's explanation of the brand sounded to me as if the horse had originated on a ranch which belonged to the Mikado. Later, Lucas Barclay in town clarified that it was the brand of the Mankato Cattle Company in North Dakota. And no, Angus, I wouldn't know either what a Mankato horse is doing 600 miles from home, nor would I ask into the matter, as long as I had a firm bill of sale from Isaac Reese. While I was making up my mind there about Scorpion, Isaac Reese was eyeing my colossal Texican saddle on the Dantley mare. He inquired dubiously, "Do you come from Texas?" "No, not quite that bad. How much do you want for this allegorical horse?" My second year as the South Fork schoolteacher, it was an entire month before the end of school when Ninian Duff made his appearance in my schoolroom again. "Ninian," I inquired when he had done rehiring me again, "did you ever see the word temporary in a dictionary? Angus, we know this asks much of you to take the school again, but just for next year." That same week, near the end of school, Karen Peterson was reading to us at story time. She began, "One more sun," sighed the king at evening, "and now another darkness. This has to stop. The days fly past us as if they were racing pigeons.
We may as well be pebbles for all the notice life takes of us, or we of it. No one holds in mind the blind harper when he is gone. No one commemorates the girl who grains the geese. None of the deeds of our people leave the least tiny mark upon time. Where's the sense in my running a kingdom if it all just piffles off into air? Tell me that, whoever can. If you will recall, sire. This particular day of the last week of my second South Fork year, I was perching myself on the water bucket stand at the rear of the classroom while Karen was reading. Karen, small but great with the occasion of this, sat at my big desk reading to us from the Book of Stories. In the trance of Karen's reading, even Daniel Rozier only squirmed ritually. And I took quiet pleasure in seeing those still rows of oh-so-familiar heads in front of me. Adam Willicks, did you ever have your moments of phrenology, the study of skulls, there in our Nethermuir school in Scotland? Try to test the capacities in those young heads against the way they looked from the back? I swear to heaven, Susan Duff could have ruled France with the crown of her head. How such chestnut luster and precise flow of tress had derived from old dustmop Ninian Duff was far beyond me. But Davy Erskine's crown hair flopped in various directions and no definite one, and that seemed distinctly Erskinian. But then there was the bold round crown of Eddie Van Bebber, so that you'd have thought half the brains of the human race were packed under there, and Eddie Van Bebber was only barely bright enough to sneeze. Karen reading again. Why is it, said the king, that the moon keeps better track of itself than we manage to? And the seasons put us to shame. They always know which they are, who's been, whose turn now, who comes next, all that sort of thing. Why can't we have memories as nimble as those? Tell me that, whoever can. Sire, if you will recall... Hope, spirit, deftness, kindness, tolerance, passion. I didn't know whether those were on the main neighborhoods... Those were on the main neighborhoods of a phrenologist's skull map, but they were on my ideal one as I studied those South Fork and Scotch Heaven heads in front of me there in the classroom. Each a head that I, as teacher, was to make into a literate and numerate mind. The impossibly mysterious process of patterning minds, though. How do we come to be the specimens we are? Tell me that, whoever can. Karen reading again. Oblivion, said the king. Oblivion has been the rule too long. What this kingdom needs in the time to come is some oblivion. There, that's it. We need to become oblivious. Oblivious people. Enough of this forgettery. But how to do it? It'll take some doing. What's to be done? Tell me that, whoever can. If you recall, sire, this morning... You named a remembrancer. Eh? I did. And what a good idea it was, too. For a change, things are going to be fixed into mind around here. Send me this remembering fellow. Bring forth the king's remembrancer. In time to come, when Susan Duff had grown and herself become a teacher in Helena, I've always been sure that Helena is the better for it, I could wonder if I truly affected that in any meaningful way. In time to come, during what the Fable King would call oblivion, I always remembered Daniel Rozier more vividly than Karen Peterson, and in no way under heaven was that fair. In time to come, when Davy Erskine... But that is ahead of what I need to tell now. For it was in the near time to come, the next school year, when the occurrence that was central to the rest of my life happened, not in my own classroom, but another.